Hello, everybody, and welcome back to our video commentaries on A Treatise on White Magic, focusing here on the rules for magic on the astral plane. We're in Rule 10, and this is the 19th program for Rule 10. It's a long one, and the 35th program for the rules for the astral plane. We have been dealing here with two types of fears. He says, he's given us three methods of counteracting fear. Fears which arise simply within the astral body and the personality and maybe quite unfounded. Fears which arise because something definite has precipitated on the physical plane, which works against what must be accomplished. So it is a real type of opposition, a concretized counterforce, and then a more occult attack. The fears that come when we realize that the those on the left-hand path and the brothers of form are counteracting us and warring militantly against the aspirant and the disciple. And he's given us methods of dealing with these, and these are some of the most important practical pieces of advice that we will find in this book. So, find your way to these pages, which are immediately before page 347. Now we're on 347, and we're talking about the kinds of vibrations which will come in, and they may even be of a higher sort, and they will cause disruption. So what happens when spiritual vibrations enter? Strong vibrations will come with ever-increasing frequency, and as the race progresses in evolution, the vibrations will wax stronger and their reactions must be dealt with in wisdom, because always the conditioned pattern will react against something new which tries to recondition it. It's a bit of a conflict between the conditioning of Saturn in its lower aspect and the reconditioning, the archetypalization provided by Uranus when it's functioning in a high manner. All right, so let's see here. Get this little blue bracket ready to go. Two things when the spiritual vibration, two things manifest when the spiritual vibration is exceedingly potent. And of course, this comes at periods of the full moon and so forth. All good aspirations and synchronous high vibrations are stimulated. And secondly, all that we term evil, maybe it's our mistake to call it that, but anyway, all that we term evil is likewise stimulated. And the aspirants should bear this definitely in mind. So stimulation is stimulation. And the augmentation of that which is good or bad may occur simultaneously. Okay. Now, naturally, we wish it was just the good vibrations which were stimulated, but that's not really how it is. There may demonstrate such a factor as a crime wave, but there will also demonstrate an increasing number of groups that stand for spiritual endeavor and high aspiration. So this is what we call, let's say, an example of this dual type of stimulation. The effect of the heightening of the vibration on you, the aspirant, may manifest in various ways also. It may, even if it's a high vibration, interesting, it may result in bodily fatigue, and this must be dealt with. Not so much by sleep and rest, but though a just proportion of them is needed, notice the Libran quality there, but above all by a change of vibration of recreation and amusement, even amusement. It's interesting. Now, Master Moria has basically said that rest is a change of labor. So Master DK is telling us that we need a change of vibration anyway, recreation and amusement, and Master Moria is saying, well, if you change your labor, you're going to find some degree of rest, otherwise you'll get dull through repetition. Okay, now, this is the second factor. And let's see, you know, I want to mark the first one as well. Okay, two things manifest. Okay, so let's call this the first thing that manifests. All right, let's do that. And then we'll have a good setup for that, which is secondary, or secondly, anyway. So there is a dual stimulation which occurs, a dual stimulation, the good and the bad, simultaneously. Secondly, even if it's a high vibration, it results frequently in profound depression, in an utter sinking of the heart, as the future is faced. Interesting, this phrase, the sinking of the heart. Probably we have all actually, you know, sort of physically experienced this. Face that future, however, and remember that the future, that what the future holds is not revealed, but the joy cometh in the morning. After the night, well, that's the idea. After the night of perhaps what we would term dreadful experience, joy cometh in the morning. So, you know, because we think, well, here's this high vibration. It may indicate to me some possibilities, but by my equipment, my time, my environment, whatever, it feels totally unsuited to the achievement of that vision. And my heart sinks when I think that I cannot achieve that which is indicated as a possibility. Joy cometh in the morning. Okay, well, that's a beautiful phrase. And, you know, it's good cheer because no matter what dark night we may pass through, and we will all necessarily pass through the dark nights, there will be that upliftment of identification with the soul and realization that no environmental factor can ever finally subdue the curtail, the radiation of the soul, and the experience of this expansive, loving, pervasive soul. It results also in a sensitiveness of the astral body that is perhaps more hard to bear. So, let's just say high vibrations sensitize the astral body to the point of pain. Now, this must be dealt with. It just has to be dealt with. You know, sometimes we have to just find our own way to deal with these problems. This must be dealt with by the individual as best he may, bearing in mind the suggestions that I have given him. And there are plenty of them in the foregoing, including not the suppression of the astral body, but the disidentification with it and the identification with something more real within, so that one becomes the observer and not identificatorily in the middle of all the pain. It results also in a permanent stimulation of the atoms in the various vehicles and their coherent stabilization. It lifts a little nearer to the goal. Though perhaps the aspirant may not realize it. Okay. Yeah. So the high vibrations, though experienced at times painfully and depressively, do in fact uplift and bring us closer to the desired objective, the goal. And I printed God there. Maybe God is the goal there. God as being, God as our true identity. It's hard to escape the cleavage making, dichotomization of the mind. You know, we look at all these different things around us and they look like separate things, but to the initiate, they're not separate things. And to the uninitiate, they are, because the mind has dichotomized them, put them in separate categories which seem not to be able to be bridged, but we have to bridge difference. Okay. The, I'll call it the infusceptional bridging of apparent difference. Infusceptional. I don't suspect there's going to be a word like that, but I'll try to make it. Come on now. Here we go. Infusceptional bridging of apparent difference, so that something pervades all these differences, which gives unity and ultimately sameness, that unites and makes us one. All the apparent differences, we just have to find our way beyond difference. When I was younger, I heard the phrase that the wise one looks in all directions and sees nothing but the same. I don't think I could understand it, because it seemed to negate that which the perceptions presented. But in fact, in the Mahamaya, the perceptions will present what they will present, but there is the realization that all of it is really the same. And I find that this realization deepens as one works with it, as one goes on, as one reminds oneself of these factors. This is such a practical book, you know, and even as Master DK is teaching us, he's also teaching us how to teach others. Because there's so much here that we can suggest to people who may not be familiar with it, and it will help them, even as his very practical suggestions are helping us. Everything depends upon the pupil's ability to grasp the inner meaning of all events. Now, what is that, you know, when you think about that grasping of the inner meaning? And I would call it by this following name, spiritual discernment, found on the, you know, the third sublevel of the mental plane, as a power, we might say. His entire progress upon the path rests upon his attitude in making the teaching his own. Okay, not just fun to read, but that inner monitor must reveal at the appropriate moment that which the teaching has implanted within us, and then we believe it, and we experiment, and we apply, and we confirm, and increasingly, it becomes our own. So, in order, it is only as we transmute the lessons on the inner planes into practical knowledge that they become part of our experience and are no longer theoretical. Theory is the beginning of much of this, and maybe people are willing to accept theoretically much that they cannot verify and accept as practically demonstrated as true, but it's a start. Expansion of consciousness should be an ever increasing practical experience. Wow. So, you know, I hear the words. I hear the words. And I'm aware that I have studied, and probably you have studied, so many things that cannot yet be put into practice because they really do lie beyond, but they have analogies and lower analogies, and these analogies can be properly applied. Analogical processes reflecting what we cannot put into practice, these analogical lower reflections can be put into practice. Theories are of no value until we have changed them into fact. Maybe there's some kind of mental construct value, so we have maybe a truer idea of how things are, you know. Let's just say very few scientists can put the theory of relativity right now into practice, but some can. We can't, probably, but we can at least try to understand it. Theories are of no value until we have changed them into fact. It's such a clear statement that we have to go beyond our theoretical approach. We must. And as we progress in occultism, so much that seemed strange but possible will become familiar and actual. Hence the value of meditating on an ideal such as the Master in the Heart, or our own ideal image in the heart. In the meditation, our thoughts vibrate temporarily to the meditation of the conception, measure of the conception. And in time, that vibration becomes permanent. So, therefore, meditate on the ideal to stabilize the true conception as a permanent vibration and a permanent ability. We're growing constantly, you know, such as we are. We're filling out the causal body. We're just beginning to be aware of it, and that we can consciously fill it with virtue, strength. We're learning how to do this, not in a haphazard way, but in a progressive manner. And let's see. Was I correct? Was I incorrect? I said we start on page 3. Yeah, okay. So now we're moving on to another page. Those who, with eyes open, enter on occult training need indeed to count the cost. This is like, you know, this fine advice from some elderly uncle who has been through it all and is trying to help us do the same. He is wiser, happier but wiser, happier and wiser. And during some of the process, we may feel we are sadder but wiser because we've had to relinquish certain attachments, which previously apparently gave us happiness, but okay. The reward at the end is great, but the path is rough and the true occultist walks it alone. Wow. I mean, you know, I'm so many of these phrases that have been ringing in my ears for these almost 50 years that I've been studying this material are shown, you know, I'm seeing where they come from here. You sort of remember the statement, but you may really forget the source. You may forget the source. The reward at the end is great, but the path is rough. We call it the thorny path of occultism. So there, you know, it's like the sting of the scorpion. I once got stung by I think a very little scorpion in Australia. Wow, it was I think I just grazed me, but it was a shock of pain. Anyway, from thorns, we get the shock of pain, and on the thorny path of occultism, we get the shock of pain. The reward at the end is great, but the path is rough, and the true occultist walks it alone. Or in the all one, we might say, including all ontologically in terms of being, but somehow because of that extension of the monad into privation, walks it alone. The monad extends itself into relative privation, and thus the true occultist, as that extension, walks the path. No, that's pairs of opposites. Let's see. Oh, that would be a good one, wouldn't it? POOC. We would say, no. I want to get the path of occultism here. Sorry. Okay. Well, that's not going to be easy, and I've had to stop, unfortunately, which may interrupt the continuity of thought, I well realize. Path of occultism. I'll try to remember that. And walks the path of occultism alone, yet all one. The capacity to stand alone, to assume responsibility and then carry all through single-handed, and to brave evil for the sake of the good achieved, is the mark of the White Brother. I'd like to send that to a number of people that I know and to myself. I'd like to send that out because it's so powerful. The capacity to stand alone, apparently alone, of course, because there are many on watchers, you know, and, well, really, we're one being. You can't be alone. You can only be all one. But this is such is the nature of the great illusion and our particular perception at this time within the Mahamaya, which is the great illusion, the capacity to stand alone, to assume responsibility, and then to carry all through single-handed and to brave evil for the sake of good achieved, is the mark of the White Brother. Think about braving evil. What makes a brave? You know, in the Native American, a brave willingness to confront the opposition, which may be even lethal, but not running away, not shrinking back, not recoiling. The willingness to face the opposition. Mars is the planet which so often gives this willingness to go forth and willingly face the perhaps deadly opposition, having full faith in the immortality of the inner God. You know, a lot of those warriors of the past in Greek times and so forth, they knew that if they died, they would be shortly in the realm of Hades. Hades was not hell. It was simply the shadow world, the astral plane, and so forth. They knew their life would continue. As Master DK says, there is no death. There is no death. There is no death. Be prepared then for loneliness, for dangers of a dim and obscure character, and expect to see your life spent for no reward that touches the personality. It's just one good statement, good sentence after another, memorable. And I've memorized or remember these anyway. They've been with me, lo, these many decades. Be prepared then for loneliness, for dangers of a dim and obscure character. Maybe some of us become familiar with these occult attacks. And expect to see your life spent for no reward that touches the personality, but okay. If it touches the soul, that's what we want. It is only as the consciousness expands and one finds one's true position in the cosmic whole that the reward becomes apparent, but cease from fear and know that the personality is only temporary, and what matter if it suffer? It seems that, you know, in this particular book, I want to underline everything. I had a friend. He read through the entire, what was it? One of those books, maybe it was Letters on Occult Meditation. He underlined everything, absolutely everything. I think he had a very strong sixth ray. It is only as the consciousness expands and one finds one's true position in the cosmic whole and sees that there has been actually an elevation of position spiritually compared to where one was positioned before, that the reward becomes apparent. But the whole point of all this section that we've been dealing with is cease from fear and know that the personality is only temporary, is that there's something behind it that's real, it's lasting. And the personality will always de-aggregate. The mask will always fall to pieces. It cannot be preserved. That which becomes cannot be preserved. Only that which is, and even the archetypes themselves, are not preserved except in the realm of absolute infinitude, which is post and pre-universal altogether. So what matter if it suffer? Well, we have to get used to that idea, because even if we don't think so, I think we're quite identified, more so than we think, with the personality. Some good gained for the universal brotherhood, some law explained and demonstrated in the life of every day, as in the case of the Christ, the law of love, you know, not considering it the sixth systemic law, but something more, a cosmic law, the law of attraction. Some good gained for the universal brotherhood, some law explained and demonstrated in the life of every day, may make the master say, eventually, yes, eventually, after it's all over, well done. They just don't want to speak prematurely, because so much more is lost through premature compliments than through some chastening, which may seem unpleasant at the moment, but guards the quality of what is being attempted. So we have to get, you know, poor Milarepa, he had that. And fortunate Milarepa, he had the teacher Marpa, who basically said every time Milarepa built a structure he was instructed to build, Marpa said, no, not here, there. Then later, no, not there, somewhere else, and somewhere else, and somewhere else. Until Milarepa's lower personality sense was defeated. And Milarepa emerged from that life at least as an initiate of the fourth degree, and maybe he made astonishing progress and even achieved some kind of mastership. But it's better than giving compliments which force or encourage the reduction of the necessary point of tension. Compliments, oh, what a relief. And then your point of tension just dissipates, and your ability to accomplish dissipates along with the point of tension. So this is where Master Dikei really shows his kind of aspiration, kind of will that got him where he is. Let your eyes, therefore, look straight on. Turn not to the right hand, nor to the left. The path leads upward and on to greater rapidity of vibration and to greater sensitiveness. Seek the point of balance in your work and keep that balance. For the years hold much work, much pressure, and much suffering. Well, you know, I'm just so grateful for the kind of strong advice that's being offered here in words that you cannot really resist. You cannot brush them aside. They go right into you, into your mind, into your heart. And at some point when the going really gets rough, such words as this will come to us. Let your eyes, therefore, look straight on. Turn not to the right hand nor to the left. The path leads upward. We're told it winds upward all the way. It's a poem. The path leads upward and on to greater rapidity of vibration and to greater sensitiveness. Hard to bear, though. Seek the point of balance in your work so that the work may be preserved and not fall apart. And keep that balance. Tread the noble middle path, I guess we're being told. For the years hold much work, much pressure. Which Master Moria says, this pressure is the law of existence, and much suffering. Are we willing to bear it? I suppose when we find out what we really are and see ahead to what is coming, we are willing. This is, you know, I love these exhortations. I guess it appeals to my sixth ray, you know. And we do know that Master Dikei had plenty of that, as some of the older masters jested. Are you strong enough to see the world's woe? To see disaster and yet keep joyful? That's a special strength, to preserve joy. Oops, I see what the problem is here. A special strength to preserve joy in the face of disaster and suffering. Yes, it's a special ability. And he's asking, you know, can we do it? Can we really do it? Can you be a partner in the work of furthering the evolution of the race and see the necessity for trouble and for discipline, and yet not move to stem the tide of sorrow? Okay, well, I'm sorry, I was called away here for a minute, so let me repeat this. This is an exhortation. And, you know, Master Dikei is aware that in teaching, exhortations are really necessary because we have our aspirational level has to be lifted. We're not yet at the stage where, you know, we are pure will. We hardly know what will is. So we can accomplish much through an elevated aspiration. And so he challenges us to have something powerful arise within us to do the job. Are you strong enough to see the world's woe? To see disaster and yet keep joyful, because joy cometh in the morning and joy will be for everybody. And it will all look like a dream. Is life a dream? There's an old song about that. And I never could understand it, but increasingly studying occultism, I do understand it. It's the inner worlds that are not the dream. To die perchance to dream. Aye, there's the rub. That's, you know, from Hamlet, but this is the dream. Can you be a partner in the work of furthering the evolution of the race and see the necessity for trouble and for discipline and yet not move to stem the tide of sorrow? Well, you know, that's a hard one, because naturally one wants to move to stem the tide of sorrow. And yet, Master Moria says, obstacles are possibilities. So we have to be very judicious and see what the outcome of the discipline may be. To give all, he says, is to put on chains. And if we give all, we will produce weaklings, he says, and not the kinds of strong workers that the hierarchy needs. Picked and tried souls are being trained all over the world at the present time. So there is a process of selection by the masters, who they will train. The masters, this is, you know, late 20s, early 30s, the masters are overwhelmed with the work, and their time is overoccupied. Maybe we forget that, you know, we think we're so busy and so hard-pressed, but it's the old camel and donkey, you know. They can carry the load of the camel and put it on us, and we give way immediately. The masters are overwhelmed with the work, and their time is overoccupied. They give what they can, but on the individual aspirant depends the use of that which is given. You know, this is the old horse to water adage. And, you know, maybe in they tried to make the horse drink, they drowned the horse. Well, we are the horse in this case, and we've been led to the waters of life. We've been led to the great spiritual teaching. This is just a wonderful section. Those of us who watch and guide on the inner side of life realize more than perhaps you who bear the burden and heat of physical plane existence know. I think this is even so good, you know, that this was transported into the discipleship book, so we'd have maybe another chance, another go at it. We realize more than perhaps you know. We know your physical disabilities, and someday may be able to help definitely in building up strong bodies for world service. And let's just say he told us in the seventh ray age, this will happen, because it will be such a connection with the etheric body and its strengthening via that ray. Now, such is the astral miasma. It is well nigh impossible for you, our struggling brethren, to have good health. Well, that's a direct statement, you know. And we may wonder, all around us are the corruptors of health. And I think things have improved quite a bit. I think if I can switch around here a little bit, things will be a little better. Yeah, maybe so. The karma of the world prohibits good health. Now, you know, early 30s, the storm was gathering. It is well nigh impossible for you, our struggling brethren, to have good health. And I guess when Master DK talks about good health, he's talking about something that is a lot more vibrant than what we call good health. The astral corruption and the foul cesspools of the lower levels of the mental plane infect all, and lucky is he who escapes. Well, they can see these things, and we don't even suspect them. We watch with tenderness all of you who, with weak and sensitive bodies, struggle, work, fight, fail, continue, and serve. If you hear some pounding in the background, it's just the ongoing work around here, you know, rain pouring through the roof, have to fix the roof, okay. We watch with tenderness all of you who, with weak and sensitive bodies, struggle, work, fight, fail, continue, and serve. Not one hour of service given in pain and tension, not one day's labor followed with racked nerves, with head tired, and with heart sick, is allowed to pass unnoticed. It's, you know, really, it's beautiful about their solicitude for the likes of us. And as I say, Master DK doesn't lie, you know, it's how it is. That's how he sees it, and that's what they do. We know, and we care. Yet we may do naught that you, struggling in the field of the world, can do of that which is needed. The world's karma engulfs each of you at this epoch, if you could but realize that the time is short, and rest, joy, and peace are on their way. I've often remarked or thought about how in former days and even today when someone dies, they say, well, rest in peace. Eternal rest. I think that'd be horrible. But the law of periodicity has to be obeyed, and there will be periods of expression and periods of pralaya, manvantara, the universal manvantara, and then pralaya, and onward forever in that way, as it has forever been. But relatively, these are extremely unnatural and pressured times for those who are willing to take upon themselves even something of the burden, you know. The half-gained victory, the days lived through with a certain measure of success, yet with an unachieved ideal, the minutes of exhaustion of soul and body when the emptiness of everything, even of service itself, seems the only noticeable thing, the weeks and months of endeavor and of struggle against apparently insuperable odds, against the stupendous power of the forces of evolution, against the roaring tide of the world's ignorance, are all known. Take comfort in the assurance that love rules all. Take courage from the realization that the hierarchy stands. I don't know, tears come to my eyes when I read that, because it's just so wonderful. And of course, these are the odds against us. I don't know, maybe things were harder in those days as the Great War was ramping up on the internal planes. Master Mori was talking about the epidemic of obsession. He was writing as if the Black Lodge was really active, I suppose in a way that only the occultists could see. So this is also found elsewhere in the books, I think, transported into the Dyna books. The roaring tide of the world's ignorance. That's a phrase which has really stuck with me. And yet even the stupendous forces of evolution going towards a destination which we cannot fathom and being irresistible can cause great distress. We move on towards a great destiny, but meanwhile, the things we've been holding on to are shattered. What then? Well, the faith, the faith. Take comfort in the assurance that love rules all on our planet, in our solar system, take courage from the realization that the hierarchy stands. And I just got to say, you know, like, what a great assertion. Take courage from the fact that the hierarchy stands. Take courage from the realization that the hierarchy stands. Take courage from the realization that the hierarchy stands. I'd like to, you know, just get that into my deep understanding so that in the dark moments, I too and all of us can take courage from the realization that the hierarchy stands. Those who are to teach the world more about the masters and who are being trained to be focal points of contact are put through a very drastic disciplining. And do we even notice the elements of that disciplining? They are tested in every way possible and taught much through bitter experience, which they will not repeat if the impression of the harm done is sufficient. Think about your bitter experiences. You know, sometimes, well, whatever they may be for you, sometimes they're deaths, sometimes they're divorces and breaking up of relationships, sometimes they are loss. You know, I had a friend whose house burned down entirely, along with what looked like his life savings in cash in the house. You know, bitter experiences that lead to a condition eventually of loving detachment. They are a taught to attach no importance to recognition. That's coming in there at the beginning of Rule 11, giving up all desire for recognition. They are trained not to judge from the appearance, but from the inner vision. But can we discern it? That's the question. Capacity to recognize the master's purpose and the ability to love are counted of paramount importance. So let us not be misled by superficialities, but in fact spiritually discern that which lies beneath the apparency. So, well, maybe people like ourselves are really being put through it, a very drastic disciplining. I feel that we have to remember that if our life does not seem especially easy, and yet it's probably nothing compared with what they are carrying, and in comparison with the life of many whom we do not know, but whose lives are extremely stressful because they carry even more. Aspirants who seek to be chosen for work as disciples must lose all desire for the things of self and must be willing at any cost to pay the price of knowledge. As I read this, I see, you know, that I've tried to base my life on a lot of this. It was early on in the game, and whether or not one succeeds is a big question. Aspirants who seek to be chosen. Now, of course, you know, the accepting disciple chooses. The accepting disciple gives credence to that which has been taught. He accepts it. And the old saying is, many are called, but few are chosen. And that's true, but many are called, and few choose to live up to the call. So few choose is also true, an act of will to choose. The aspirants who seek to be chosen for work as disciples, and I suppose accepted disciples, I suppose this, you know, because the master determines that. Must lose all desire for the things of self and must be willing at any cost to pay the price of knowledge. Well, test yourself. I'll test myself. Are we willing at any cost to pay the price of knowledge? I mean, you can lose a lot as you pursue the knowledge. You can lose reputation. You can lose your financial stability. You can lose your relationships if someone in the relationship is wanting something else. You can lose secondary things. If proof is to be given to the world of the subjective realm of reality, it will be bought with the heart's blood, for only in the blood of the heart can power be safely gained and wisely wielded. Reminds me of, that very militant kind of master, Master Hilarion, in his Light on the Path. And he asks you to rip evil out of your heart, and then the heart will bleed, and we have to somehow tolerate this and recognize the moment when it's happening. We can understand that certain esoteric approaches are absolutely necessary, but do we recognize when they need to be applied? That's the question. If proof is to be given to the world of the subjective realm, and right now not so many believe in it, except vaguely of heaven and hell, of reality, it will be bought with the heart's blood. There's the absolute need for sacrifice. For only in the blood of the heart can power be safely gained and wisely wielded. We have to demonstrate always that we are ready and willing to sacrifice. As you go on, and as aspirants study the hidden laws of nature, you will realize the need for the price paid. And somehow, I do remember the old days when I was reading this, and it's now coming back to me, decades later. I see more, and all of us will see more as we keep living the life, and what was theoretical will have demonstrated itself as practical and real. The spiritual unfoldment of the disciple's character must keep pace with his inner knowledge. I suppose that's the reason why the fifth ray ashram was suspended in its activities, maybe from 1950 to year 2000 or maybe beyond, because the character, moral character of human beings had not kept pace with the bounding pace of knowledge acquired. This knowledge grows in three waves. Okay, so let's call this the method of growth of inner knowledge. Okay, how? By definite expansions of consciousness which open up to the disciple the realization of the points to be attained, and one might almost say the points of tension to be attained. This produces in his mind a formulation of what lies ahead to be grasped, and is the first step towards acquirement. An aspirant is definitely taken on the inner planes and shown by a more advanced chela what is the work to be done, much in the same way as a pupil is shown by his master the lessons to be learned. So we might call this, in a way, seeing ahead under guidance by the more advanced. So at least we have to have some kind of conception of what may lie ahead. And interesting, you know, these things may be well forgotten, but even an aspirant, not even one who is necessarily yet a disciple, is definitely taken on the inner planes, I suppose during the hours of sleep, and shown by a more advanced chela what is the work to be done. And maybe a true aspirant has taken the first initiation. If one is a chela, really, one has taken the first initiation. So we see maybe the point at which this showing is occurring. Okay, so, you know, I'll kind of underline these major points as we go through them. You know, I think I can see a lot of value in memorizing all these tabulations, so we see the sequence of things. So we're shown something, okay? This is how knowledge is gained, And we'll call it here. More, don't be too fast. More on how knowledge is gained. The next step is the mastering of the lesson and the working out in meditation and experiment of the truths sensed. So the conception, the foresight is good. It's a start, but next comes something where we actually make that which we see our own. This is a lengthy process, for all has to be assimilated and made part and parcel of the disciple's very self before he can go on. And that's what I'm, you know, thinking. 7 years remain until 2025. How much can we assimilate and make, as he says, part and parcel? Wrap it up. It resembles the work, resembles the working out of a sum, well, before the era of computers, perhaps. But anyway, you know, the laborious hands-on method in your mind. Figure by figure, line by line, the working out being carried forward until the answer is achieved. The work is done both on the inner planes and on the physical. In the hall of learning, that's the second tier of petals, isn't it? Pretty much. The pupil is taught nightly for a short time before proceeding with any work of service. So if we're engaged in a work of service related to the hierarchy, maybe we can realize that we have been shown something about how to proceed. This teaching he brings over into the physical brain consciousness in the form of a deep interest in certain subjects and in an increasing aptitude to think concretely and abstractly on the various occult matters that are occupying his attention. So we may not recall exactly the kind of guidance, the kind of instruction we received on the inner side in preparation for certain parts of service, but we will be deeply, deeply interested. And we'll be able to think about these things, and not only in the abstract, but in a way which will help them occur. And of course, DK is assuming that spiritual occultism will be foremost on our mind, because we need to reveal the truth of the inner things to people so they can have a truer sense of values almost immediately. When you think about the time equation here, it's needed almost immediately. He attempts to experiment and tries various methods of studying the laws, and in process of time arrives at results which are of value to him. You know, and we say, guided by his own deep interest, which is impelled by the inner instruction. Time passes, and as he appropriates and knows more, his knowledge takes a synthetic form, and he becomes ready to teach and to impart to others the residue of knowledge of which he is sure. I, you know, sometimes wonder how much of Master DK's writing have we assimilated. I sometimes test myself on this, and, you know, maybe I'm climbing towards 2 or 3%, but then when I reevaluate it, I feel that it's less than 1%. I mean, really, to be honest, generalities, yes, but there's such incredible specificity here that if we are really to examine what has been given, our percentage of assimilation is very low, the residue is very low, but we can give something. So we have to look ahead, we have to master the lessons, and basically this is the hour point. But can I go on? Will I be interrupted? Almost certainly. Or something that has to be done on the concrete levels. It's real, the concrete levels are real. Or maybe actual, maybe they're not really real, but they're real enough. All right, so onward then. This is 1 hour of number 35. In teaching others comes further knowledge. I can really attest to that, and I'm sure many teachers can. The old saying is, maybe the listener is gaining 5%, maybe the teacher is gaining 95% of that which is taught. The definition of truth in teaching crystallizes the facts learned, and in the play of other minds, i.e., webinars, classes, so forth, the aspirant's own vibration becomes keyed up to ever higher planes, and this fresh intuition and fresh, what? And this fresh intuition and fresh something, and fresh reaches of truth, yes, pour in. So teaching leads to learning. And I think, all of us who really are students of this, we have to remind ourselves of this. Maybe we're working in a school like the Archean School for Esoteric Studies, maybe Moria Federation, whatever. And do I dare to teach? Do I know enough? Well, we never know enough, but we know enough. And so at a certain point, we say, well, I've received a certain amount of light, and I can pass that light on. And then, as we start to pass it on, our light, the light in our consciousness, really begins to grow. So, I would encourage all of you who are students of this great teaching to reach that point where you say to yourself, I will pass it on. It can be humble at first, and just a few people, or even one, or whatever, in a conversation, but pass it on, and you will find that your understanding of the teaching will grow. I mean, I can certainly attest to that, and I think I'm not alone. As I have to attempt to explain things, I'm explaining them to myself too, and gaining in my deeper understanding. So may it be for all of us. When one lesson has in this way been mastered, a further one is set, and when a pupil has learnt a particular series of lessons, he graduates and passes an initiation. So DK puts initiation in terms that are very easy to understand, just like in a school. And as a matter of fact, all the planets are schools. He calls them planetary schools. And if you just turn to the end of esoteric astrology, and well, it's also in cosmic fire, but the different schools, school on Venus, school on Mercury. Some are missing, of course, because maybe too much knowledge about them would not be wise for us at this point. The whole group he teaches is benefited by his step forward. For every disciple carries those he instructs along with him in a curious and indefinable sense. So, Master DK is a great teacher here, and he became a master in 1875, we are told, and he's working with Blavatsky even before that in Tibet. And just think, over the many, many years, I don't know how many years, 50, 60, maybe 70, 80, years of teaching. He's gained a lot, because this certainly applies to him as to any other master. In teaching comes further knowledge. And Alice Bailey was taking a lot of things down, you know, for him, and then great vistas of possibility appeared to her that were not even dictated by him because of this service of reception and transmission. The benefit to the unit reacts upon the whole, and also that which is non-beneficial. A master carries his disciples on and up with him in a similar manner, of course. And some of us have questioned, well, when will Master D.K. be a Chohan, and do we know? Is he already a Chohan? We have the Chohan M and the Chohan K.H., and they work with Master D.K. as an expression. Master D.K. is closely related, not only to K.H., but to M. But maybe his day is coming or has come. It's hard to say. A master carries his disciples on and up with him. I, if I be lifted up, will draw all men unto me. That's the story of magnetism. It shouldn't be interpreted only in Christian terms. The matter is abstruse and largely one of the secrets of the law of vibratory expansion. Which ones of the laws of the soul does it talk about? Is it the law of, is it magnetic expanse, or let's see, law of the lower four? Let's just see quickly. So, law of the lower four, because an expansive response will be right near it. There it is, the law of expansive response. Well, maybe that's it. I once tried to say a little bit about it, but it's hard to say much about these last two laws. We pretty much end with the law of elevation, or the law of group progress, the fifth law, which is, you might think it's Aquarian, but it's really a Capricornian law, but administered in the age of Aquarius, it will be even more powerful. So, you know, go to Cosmic Fire here and study the laws and the symbols. I've tried to bring that forward, I think, in some video commentaries along the way. Okay. So, we are all lifting each other or causing a suppression of elevation, oftentimes unconsciously. And if we rise automatically, those with whom we are deeply affiliated will also be inclined to rise. They will have a support which elevates them. And so we are also responsible for our misdeeds and possibly dragging others down in ways that we cannot easily fathom. So what have we been studying here? A few points. We've been saying knowledge grows in three ways. That's been our little theme here. It's possible to get so involved in the work of explaining various connections that we may forget. What is the subject? So knowledge grows in three ways: by definite expansions of consciousness, which open up to the disciple a realization of points to be attained, so we see to the future conceptions. We're shown the vision. You know, we might almost say, this is about the vision. Oh, come on now. And then the next step is the mastering of the lessons and the working out in meditation and experiment of the truth sense. So it's not just a vision, it's making it one's own. Okay, so not just a vision, but making the vision one's own through a kind of mastery. And then finally here, in teaching others, because now, you know, once you've mastered something, you have to impart it. Isn't it so? So once you have mastered a field, you are obliged to impart it. I see this, you know, I spent a lot of time in the operatic field and I saw wonderful performers do their thing and demonstrate the peak of excellence. But the time came when maybe circumstances, health, the physical body wore out, whatever. They were invited to teach and convey that which they had so beautifully demonstrated on the stage. So, you know, whatever we have managed to master, to gain control over, to utilize, apply, whatever, we do have to pass it on. And we're not really successful, nor is the human race successful unless degrees of mastery are passed on to others who are aspiring towards them. It's just such a shame when knowledge gets all locked up in the one who possesses it and cannot find even an appropriate way of being passed on. So let us remember that. I remember working with Charles Jane, you know, telling little anecdotal things here, and I don't know why I'm inclined to do it, but I met him in 1985, and he died in 1985. I met him in January 1985. He was passed on by December 31st, 1985. It was all part of a thing, you know. I was working at the Arcane School. We weren't encouraged exactly to talk to the people that came in the office, but I knew he was a famous astrologer and just well-known and excellent. And I remember sort of being held at bay that I couldn't speak with him. Others were speaking with him and basically kind of rebuffing him in terms of what he came to do. But I found my way out the back door in the hallway when he was leaving, and I made contact with him, and that led to an ongoing Sunday morning meeting for almost the whole year. I learned a lot, but not as much as my friends better versed in that kind of astrology learned. And his whole system was passed on to others because I kind of dared to go out that back door and say, "Hey, Mr. Jane, I'm really interested in what you have to say." So he was the teacher that year, and he had that once he looked at me in the middle of the year and he got kind of a shiver. He says, "Ooh," he said, "I feel like I'm emptying the bowl." You know how that is before you die, you pass on everything that you can. "I feel like I'm emptying the bowl." I guess he was. And because he did, and I passed on whatever he gave to me to others even more capable than myself, his work was again preserved to a further extent and was able to enter the mainstream. Well, it'll never be the mainstream. It's very complex. His work is all about how there are 49 internal charts for every human being. And I know some in the pre-computer days who spent their whole life working out their own 49 charts. The degree of complexity is just overwhelming. But there are those interior charts. And the astrologer Nicholas Nilén is very accomplished. He knows about those. And he can pass on to others now what he has learned as a result of coming in contact with this material, which would have just died all locked up with Charles Jane. So remember, everyone, that when we have something and the bowl is got some content of value, it's got to be emptied in the right way so that others can benefit. It doesn't do any good to just take it with you to the grave, you know. Anyway, my little lessons here, if you'll abide with my anecdotal, my stories. Okay, now the second initiation, he says, marks the crisis of the control of the astral body. After the baptism, and then, okay, it's called the baptism, and it's the toughest lesson for the 2, 4, 6 types, and for those maybe upon the first ray. tough test. Okay, toughest, tough test. So, you know, I've told this story, but so many people, the sort of applicants to the second initiation, they really think somehow they're applicants to the fourth initiation. Maybe there's some similarities. I think that leapfrog method, you know, my old friend, Robert Girard, he lived to be 95 years old, at least, I think, something like that. He would be now 102, but he was very, very tough, wonderful psychologist and esotericist. And he said, well, it's a leapfrog thing. You know, when you're taking the first, some of the qualities and capacities and demands of the third are brought home to you. Take the second, it's thus with the fourth. Take the third, it's thus with the fifth, the leapfrog. Or maybe we just look at it as kind of a resonance factor. So, but this question of taking the second initiation and taking the fourth, thinking you're taking the fourth is a common mistake, because there's a lot of suffering involved in that second initiation. And when we suffer, we naturally think we're going through the crucifixion, but D.K. straightened this out on that matter in the later letters to his disciple, I.S.G.L. Yeah, group love was one of those things. And stability, too. I'm forgetting what the I was, but, you know, I can go back and get it. Anyway, his name, he had some ashrams on the physical plane in North Carolina. What's the name of that nice city in North Carolina where spiritual things tend to happen? Can't think of it at the moment. And also in Montana and various groups of students. The reputation is that his students knew their stuff. But he was very first ray, and they overestimated him, and he overestimated himself. It's so easy to do, you know. He had a lot of Leo, and it's easy to overestimate. Well, you know, they used to say about Ronald Reagan that he had wandered into his anecdotage. Interesting combination of words. It's older people get, they tend to tell stories and little anecdotes, you know. So I'm trying to make them relevant to what we may be reading here. I hope I'm not boring you to death. The crisis of the astral body, and so many of DK's students in his peripheral ashram there, they were on the periphery of his ashram, they had that in sight, the second degree. Some were passing through it, some would in the next life or the next couple of lives, you know. May take a long time, or it may not take so long. But generally, the time between first and second is a long time, generally, but it might not be, depending upon how we handle time and the purity of our consecration to the task. After the baptism, there remain the three temptations, demonstrating the complete control of the lower three vehicles, and everybody's got to go through it. You know, it's not just how the Christ demonstrated. He demonstrated these things on a very high level, but we all pass through that. And the world, the flesh, and the devil, you know. So if we pass, then we're ready to go onto the path of initiation. If we pass the world, flesh, and the devil in our encounter with the lower nature in the, quote, desert, then we are ready for the continued progress on the Syrian path of initiation. Then comes the transfiguration, followed by knowledge of the future, because the higher psychism enters now, you know, involving the Ajna Center. The higher psychism enters, involving the Ajna Center, and complete self-abnegation, and that's at the fourth degree. Some third degrees don't have that yet. At the fourth degree, we have the story. I repeat it: the rich young man, take what you have, sell it, give the money to the poor, and follow me. Well, it's not complete self-abnegation yet. He didn't do it, but of course now, by now, that was a long time ago. He did that, and he's passed on, and he's probably some high initiate in some capacity. So, what do we have here? The moment of conception, which we liken to individualization, that's the, the birth of that which will become millions of years later, the initiate. 9 months of gestation, and that 9 months is millions of years. We've all been through it, you know. I mean, if I say to you that those who are really interested in these matters have been through maybe 99% of their lives as a human being, it might seem like an exaggeration, but I once did kind of work it out in terms of the thousands of lives we have and the millions of years we spent, and it certainly seemed like in excess of 99%. And then the first initiation, the birth hour. So all this process is a moving, is an entry into the fourth kingdom of nature, and thence much later into the fifth kingdom of nature. The path is therefore a path on which steady expansion of consciousness is undergone with increasing sensitivity to the higher vibrations. It's pretty hard to look ahead and say, well, you know, what is the next higher vibration? And what does that feel like? Until we do achieve it and look back and see that we hadn't achieved it before. So from the point of view of having achieved it and then stabilizing that vibration, we can see and understand the lower vibrations in which we had spent a lengthy time in prison of a psychological kind. So consciousness is expanded. That's what the path of initiation is. It's a subtle something, this consciousness. It's not really material. It's more relational. It's one thing touching another. And it's the result of impression. It's difficult to define the non-material nature of consciousness. But you know it when things come to light. And before they come to light, you know, it's like being in a dark room. You don't know what's there. You can feel your way around, maybe get a guess, but then a window opens and, all that's there. And I didn't know it before, and now I see it. Couldn't see it in the dark. Or the night sky, you know, it's very interesting, the work of Uranus. It's all dark. You're having a storm at night, but lightning flashes and lights up for a split second. All that is around, well, that's that very first of the processes which we've been looking at here, and that's the opening up to a realization of the points to be attained, the seeing ahead, even if for just a short moment. And maybe during the initiation ceremony, we only see for a short moment because something like lightning occurs. And the one initiator is ruled by Uranus in a way, and he's imparting the lightning of revelation. But that revelation has to become a steady realization, which means we have to work it out in experience. It's not just being given to us. It's being indicated, and then by our own powers, we work it out. So the path is one of steady expansion of consciousness, and it's undergone with increasing sensitivity to higher vibrations. And let's just say this can at first be painful. And, you know, we have the analogy of what's called growing pains. I didn't know that those were real until I experienced them myself. This works out at first as sensitiveness to the inner voice, and this is one of the most necessary faculties of the disciple, and we say hearing. Okay, let me just get rid of that. Let's just say that hearing is the first sense to open up. The great ones are looking for those who can rapidly obey the inner voice of their soul. Obey the inner voice of the soul, one of the very first out of four requirements, you know. Pay attention to the soul. Obey the inner voice, the voice of conscience, we might call it. It's in that inquire the way list, you know. It's in this book, you know. So, this is telling me that I have a very full disk. But I'm just hoping that my full disk is not that full. Otherwise, I'll be in a real pickle here. So, Cletus, no, that's not it. So let me just see. Okay, and hopefully it will tell me that I've been saving, and it didn't allow me to save. Well, that's not good. We cannot save, yes. Save as, okay. And let's just try that. And now we'll hope to see the right time. Yes, 1640, there was a save. I eliminated a lot from this computer, but it's still overstuffed. Okay, hearing is the first sense to open up. The great ones are looking for those who can rapidly obey the inner voice of their soul. And I wanted to say, you know, we were looking for this idea of inquire the way. And it's part of a fourfold list found in three places. Inquire the way, obey the inner impulses of the soul. Well, they can come in various ways, but hearing about them is the first way. Pay no attention to any worldly consideration, and live a life which is an example to others. Now, wow. Those are such simple things, but to become an adept, says DK, you have to do those things. This is in White Magic later in the book, page 583. The times are critical, and all aspirants are urged also to render themselves sensitive to the voice of the master as well. And maybe we confuse what that is at first. And hopefully we don't run off and find a bunch of misleading astral masters, as some have, with good intentions done. The master's time is fully occupied, and disciples must train themselves to be sensitive to his impression, and let's just call it his fleeting impression, economy. let's just say economy of time is of the utmost importance to the master. Okay, so, and he's not going to sit down and have coffee with you, you know. So, a word to the wise is sufficient. And we saw in the Dina books a compression of what D.K. had to impart in just a page, page and a half, maybe two, laboriously written out by Alice Bailey as a service to that group. Wasn't even her ashram, really. And that was enough to direct the life forward for a half a year, a year, or even 2 years during the war. A slight hint, a pointed finger, a hurried suggestion may be all that he has time to give, and each disciple must be on the watch. So let's just say vigilance and alertness are the watchwords of the student of occultism. The pressure upon them, the masters, is great now. Great now that they are moving closer to the physical plane. Pressure from Shambhala and pressure to deal with the vibrations arising from the physical plane. They have a two-way responsiveness required of them. So do we, hierarchy and our own physical plane. They have Shambhala in the physical plane. More souls are conscious of them than when they worked on mental levels only. They are descending at sacrificial cost. And they also, working on denser planes, are finding conditions more difficult. Even they have to guard their own health, as the stories sometimes go. The congestion found in the big cities can cause a problem. And was it Master M that said that one of his students had caused, probably very temporarily, but had caused the Master R to fall ill, something that he had done. Such was the connection. Hard to explain that, but that's what was said. So more souls are conscious of them than when they worked on mental levels only, and they also, working on denser planes, are finding conditions more difficult. But they, you know, let's just say the love of humanity impels them. And I've got to capitalize properly where it's due. The devas and disciples, aspirants and those upon the probationary path are being gathered around them, the masters now, and are being organized into groups with special work assigned. Some of what Master D.K. attempted is here indicated. He tried. And so he tried, and only he is in a position to know what was the success of it. I mean, I think, you know, never entirely the success that the originator hopes, as you probably know from your own efforts. Some souls can work only in mass formation, banded together and unified by a common aspiration. It's an earlier phase. Such are the majority of Christians, for instance, in the churches. So, independent work is not yet possible for most. These, knowing not the laws of occultism and only sensing the inner truth, work on the broad lines of preparation, you know, we might say, in relation to the path of probation. D.K. has told us that the Bible and such books are really books for the probationary path. They're not yet occult books. They hint at occultism. I mean, it was the Christ was teaching the secrets of the kingdom of heaven to his disciples, but in parables to others. Now, mostly we've got the parables, and many people sanctify the parables, you know, as if they are the last word. People are always looking for the last word, basically, because they are afraid, you know, spiritually lazy, cannot contain the idea of an eternity which has ever been, not just an eternity originant with their birth. You know, welcome to eternity. Well, someone dies and they say, now he will have eternal life. But he's always had eternal life. Life is eternal, and there's only one life. But those simple concepts take a while and many relinquishments before they are accepted as acceptable. So anyway, these masters, they are aided by bands of lesser devas or angels who suggest, guide, and control, and they, many of them are conscious self-conscious. Oh, let's see if I can, is this correct? Self-conscious, yep. Others, more advanced, work in smaller groups. They idealize more, and in them you see the thinkers and leaders of social reform, of humanitarian regeneration, and of church leadership, either Christian or Oriental. So it's moving from exclusively mass initiatives. And the higher devas guide them, and the blue and yellow devas, well, Master KH's devas are rose and blue, and blue and yellow sounds a lot like DK, as the former group are guided by blue and rose. Aha, that's interesting. Blue and rose. So Master KH seems very much involved with the mass of those who aspire, and DK more the blue and gold. Anecdotal, forgive me, but I went to a University of Michigan. The colors were the yellow and the blue. I guess these are the flag of Sweden is that way now. And there was always this glee club refrain, hurrah for the yellow and the blue. And I've always loved the yellow and the blue together. So that sort of mental factor is coming in on the yellow, and the blue is the heart factor. And when we deal with the rose, we're dealing with the solar plexus, with aspiration, and the blue, of course, depending on the shade, again, the love vibration. Back of them stands the still more advanced, the aspirants, probationers, and disciples of the world. If you say back of the church people, and even the leaders of the church people. Well, of course, when you look at the Pope and some of the high people in the church, they're obviously even initiates. And somewhere in Initiation Human and Solar, DK talked about the Master Jesus meeting with high prelates of the Anglican Church, goodness, okay, we're going to have an interesting time of it here because my chronometer has stopped working, so I just have no idea where I am, and we're going to see whether this is going to be a two-hour program or some oddity. I can't tell why it stopped working, but it did. So anyway, DK oftentimes gives hierarchical progressions of people with different capacities. And now the aspirants, probationers, and disciples are considered above the average church leader. But if Master Jesus, the Choan Jesus, is meeting with high prelates in maybe the Anglican Church or something of that nature, maybe the Catholic Church, I don't know, they are obviously initiates on the sixth ray and are in his group. So the aspirants, probationers, and disciples, they work singly or in twos or threes and never in groups exceeding nine. The occult significance of these numbers being necessary to the success of the work. Well, there's a big statement, although Master Moria is always praising the dodecahedron, the 12-fold. Assemblage, and it's an even number on top of it. But then again, of course, there is the teacher in the center, and then you have the archetype of the ashram, Christ and his 12 disciples. But anyway, for our purposes, maybe to confine ourselves to groups of nine at the most would be safest, and also, let us say, the odd numbers should be sustained, and maybe then we can learn more about the 12 and the 1 when we are something else, you know, something higher. So great white and gold devas attend their labors, and I'm thinking that a Master M works with red and gold devas. Is that correct? I think it's more or less correct. Moria devas. Let's see what kind. Okay, angels, the color is white and gold. White and gold. Okay, no, so I'm wrong. I'm wrong on that. So let's just see, save as, and hope for the best, hope for the best. So he talks about, this is going to be a tough one. I've got to be getting rid of, maybe the file is just too big. White and gold. So Master M works with white and gold devas right here. Oh, no, no. Maybe three. What does he do? Three great groups of angels, the gold, the flame colored, and the white and gold, work on mental levels with those lesser angels or devas. So he seeks to touch the inner spiritual fire. Three great groups of devas, gold, flame colored, and the white and gold. So let's put that down properly with the gold, flame colored, and the white and gold devas. Well, these are, you know, until we have the experience, these are just interesting words that direct us to what some of these great teachers can do. Back again of these three groups stand the masters and the devas of the formless levels. And let's just say, not described concretely. A great brotherhood pledged to serve humanity, the masters and the greater devas. Well, there are 140, what is it, in our solar system, 140 billion, 140,000 million devas, and 60 billion human beings, depending on what you're reading. And so a lot is the Devic solar system, and, you know, obviously we're not going to understand their categories, all of them, where we can barely understand the different categories of man. So anyway, this is a progression that he's giving us from the blue and rose, from the blue and gold, then the flame-colored, the white and gold with the aspirants and so forth, and then the flame color of Agni is added when Master M gets to work flame-colored gold and white and gold, not just white, but white and gold. All of this, of course, will make more sense to us as we go along. Movements are being set on foot to transmute, if possible, the labors of destruction into constructive work. I don't think it succeeded. There was a big goodwill movement in 1935-36, and there was the attempt to avert the war, but it precipitated, and the broom of Shambhala swept things very clean. And great was the opportunity following, and did we take advantage of that? That's the ongoing question. Or is our house as fuller, still more full of devils than it was before? The time is critical, for a pause has come in the work of the destroyers. And this is in the 1930s, right? In the 1930s. So, 1930s. There is an opportunity for the tide to turn and for the rebuilding of the body social. Well, let's just say, as it appears, humanity was not equal to this, and unfortunately, the disciples of the world also were not equal to this. And may we be now equal, because the dangers are even greater. If one can imagine, I mean, when DK is writing after the war, that the whole human experiment might have to come to an end, that's a pretty big danger. The weaponry is quite remarkable when you think of it. And this is possible, and the weaponry is advancing rapidly now. Even if, and I'm not sure about this, even if the fifth ray ashram per se is deactivated and only functioning under the greater third ray. So it is for this reason that each one of you needs to make a fresh dedication of himself to the work of redemption. Now, you know, this was written a long time ago, but I cannot see that it would not apply to us as a group right now. I would say it should. Personalities must be submerged. How do we do that? We keep on remembering who we are, and when personality promptings come up, we just don't give in to them if they are contrary to the indications of the emergent soul within us. Personalities must be submerged. Of course, there's an emphasis today on self-expression and all that, and that's fine in a way, but for the real disciples and the true aspirants who have taken the first initiation and thus are, in a sense, disciples, personalities must be submerged. We don't expect this of people who are at the stage where they're still developing their personalities. They have to, through expression and so forth. Aspirants must live harmlessly in thought, word, and deed. Well, he's just laying it out, isn't he? The rules are very straight. They're very strong. They're very tough. You know, go through the day and live harmlessly in thought, word, and deed. Live harmlessly in thought, word, and deed. That simple sentence, you know, can we live up to that? Harmlessness is the life expression of the man who realizes himself to be everywhere, who lives consciously as a soul, whose nature is love, whose method is inclusiveness, and for whom all forms are alike in that they veil and hide the light and are but externalizations of the one infinite being. Live a day harmlessly in thought, word, and deed. In this way, each of you will provide a pure channel and will become an outpost for the consciousness of the Master and provide a center of energy through which the Brotherhood can work. Now, you know, that business of becoming the outpost, we use it in our meditations. When we enter the blue disk and we start to ascend toward contact with various planets or their Devic representatives, let's say. But this is the method. Be a pure channel, and we can become then an outpost for the consciousness of the Master. And maybe not before, you know, until we are the pure channel. It's one thing to be translucent, the light can get through, but it's another thing to be transparent. Much greater intensity of light and much greater clarity in general. So the requirements of the occult life are pretty stiff. They are exacting. And as we wander in, you know, and put our hand to the plow, many are those who stop and turn around and leave the field. I've seen it. I can't believe it, you know, but, you know, I know that I've done it and others have done it. Maybe we've all done it in those vacillating days when we are first taking up the attempt to tread the path of occultism. Looks pretty unbelievable when you look back and you see now the advantages of everything that lies ahead, but that's where some people are. And, you know, you just can't scold them to death, you know, they're going to do what they're going to do. But hopefully the kind of encouragement can be offered that will help them regrip the plow and really lean into it, no matter how discouraged they may be at the moment and how much other forces are pulling upon them for some kind of satisfaction, which has been denied during the period when you've been trying very hard in relation to the path. The prime problem of the aspirant is to dominate the emotional nature. That's what the book is all about. And, you know, Master DK comes in writing at a time when quite a few people are ready for that and struggling, as the psychology of the last century has shown us and has given people opportunity. The prime problem of the aspirant is to dominate the emotional nature. Then he stands victor on the field of Kurukshetra, a plain south of the city of Delhi, India. So the story goes, where they say glass formations can be found which only could be created under the impress or under, because of the detonation of atomic weapons. Is it possible? Anyway, it was a real thing 4 million years ago, and in the psyche of every disciple, including ourselves, it's a real thing. The battle, the scorpionic battle, you know. And once having released yourself from that battle, things go faster. But there's going to be battles all along the way. Can we link Kurukshetra with the temptations in the desert? Well, maybe not. Maybe the Kurukshetra comes earlier and then you get retested in the desert following, apparently, the purification of the astral body. The clouds have rolled away, and henceforth he can walk in the light, taking the Syrian path of initiation, whether or not his path is the path to Sirius. Nevertheless, initiation on our planet, at least, is sponsored by Sirius and probably throughout the solar system, inasmuch as the solar logos is the disciple of the logos of Sirius. So dominate the emotional nature. Control the body of motion, for the waves that rise upon the stormy seas of life engulf the swimmer, shut out the sun, and render all plans futile. You know, turn to page 473 in this book and you'll see those important 15 counsels. So we become the victor, and we have thrown our lot, our energy, our dedication, our aspiration on the side of the good guys, you know, the good part of ourselves, the higher aspects of ourselves, those soul powers and the representations of soul powers within our personality. We now fight on their side, even though our opponents are of our own family. In other words, they're part of our nature, in this case, the personality nature. The clouds have rolled away, and henceforth he can walk in the light. Let it here be remembered that this very freedom to walk in the light carries with it its own problems, one after another. It looks like galaxies have problems. You know, they kind of merge, and you kind of wonder, what are the casualties in this merging? Who is swallowing whom, you know? You ask how this can be. Let me give you one simple example, and I think you will find a convincing argument. So always there are higher and higher conflicts, and the new field of freedom finds its own conflicts of a higher kind with more important results. So when a man literally walks in the light of his own soul, of his soul, and the clear light of the sun pours through him, revealing the path, it reveals at the same time the plan. Well, the actuary process, alignment, light, crisis. Let's see, alignment, light, crisis, actuary. Or is it alignment, crisis, light, revelation, and then integration and initiation and so forth? Well, we've gone through that quite a bit, and I've, in other commentary on the old commentary, I've taken this in and tried to deal with it. First comes the light that shines on the personality and reveals all the inadequacies, but almost simultaneously comes the revelation of the plan. Now, it can be that when you, you know, got yourself in hand, you're much more ready to deal with the plan, but as the plan begins to reveal itself, there's light with that, and it also reveals to you the aspects of yourself which are inadequate to handling the plan. Well, a lot of this is not just a linear process, even though DK has to deal with it at first in a linear way. Alignment causes a crisis. The crisis causes the breaking forth of the light. Then comes a revelation of the plan. Actuary, and then finally the integration. It's in that section about the integration of the soul and personality in esoteric psychology too. When a man literally walks in the light of his soul, as we are intent on doing, and the clear light of the sun, which is the angel of the presence in our own monad in extension in the causal body, when the light of the sun pours through him, revealing the path ahead, it reveals at the same time the plan. Well, that's good. That's good. The revelation of the plan, we've got to have it. Simultaneously, however, he becomes aware of the fact that the plan is as yet very far from consummation. And you know, I suppose not only in humanity in general, but in himself, the dark becomes more truly apparent. The chaos and misery and the failure of the world group stands revealed. The filth and dust of the warring forces are noted, and the whole sorrow of the world bears down upon the astounded yet illumined aspirant. It's kind of a dark night. Apparently, I don't know if he's going to deal with it here, but he says the Master Jesus had a kind of dark night of the soul. It really dawned upon his soul, not just his mind, when he was on the cross. In his soul, he realized this. So we see the failure, and we see the obstacles, and maybe we become aware of just how strong the forces of obstruction really are. Can he stand this pressure? Can he become indeed acquainted with grief and yet rejoice forever in the divine consciousness? A man of sorrows acquainted with grief. It's in the Messiah, a wonderful piece of music. If you want to know what channeling is, look at George Friedrich Handel channeling the Messiah in 21 days. Can he stand this pressure? Can he become indeed acquainted with grief and yet rejoice forever in the divine consciousness? It all depends on the manner of identification, doesn't it? Has he the ability to face what the light reveals and still go his way with serenity, sure of the ultimate triumph of the good? Will he be overwhelmed by the surface evil and forget the heart of love, which beats behind all outer seeming? This situation should ever be remembered by the disciple, or he will be shattered by what he discovers. Hence, the potential shattering of the one that walks more freely in the life of the soul. Well, you know, every one of these is a meditation for us, isn't it? We might just sit with it. How much pressure can we stand? And can we see the world's grief and rejoice in the monadic, the divine consciousness of the higher two planes, which will win out, of course? Can we face this horrible revelation and retain our serenity and assert, you know, I assert the fact, assert the ultimate triumph of good. I assert the ultimate triumph of good. Will I have a superficial point of view and see only the evil and not sense the great love of the Soul of Logos or other still greater beings moving behind the surface evil and beating out the rhythm of love? Are we going to be taken in by seeming? That's a great question concerning the Mahamaya. All of this is a seeming, but what is underneath? You know, here's where our spiritual discernment on the third level of the mental plane comes in. We've got to discern something deeper behind the outer chaos. So we better remember this or we will go to pieces, is what he's saying. And that's the problem. The freedom to walk in the light, that's the problem. It's what you see and how you react to it. Respond to it. What you see and how you respond to it. You ask how this can be. You ask how can this be. And then he explains. So, do we find ourselves at the moment being crushed by the revelation? That's the question. But with the advent of the light, he becomes aware of a new, for him, form of energy. And basically, soul and higher energies. He learns to work in a new field of opportunity. The realm of mind opens up before him. Let's just say higher mind and transcendental mind. And he discovers that he can differentiate between the emotional nature and the mental. And, well, you know, let's just say not. Whoop. This is my hope. Not be captivated by Kamala Manus, which is the condition of mind in which so many people seem to live. He discovers also that the mind can be made to assume the position of the controller and that the sentient forces respond with obedience to mental energies. So let's just call this steps towards mental polarization. The light of reason brings this about, light and eventually the light of reason, and later the light of pure reason. That's personality, that's not what I want. Pure reason brings this about, light that has always been present in man, but which only becomes significant and potent when seen and known, either phenomenally or intuitionally. So, a new relationship to the light, LT, light of reason. So we grow in strength and we can handle, we don't need to stay in this overwhelming state. I think I'll try to go as far as this. I have no idea how long it is. But a little more anyway. Much false teaching is going around these days in connection with the mind and soul. It might be summed up in the teaching of one school, which shall remain nameless, as follows. Nature is cruel and selective. She works by the law of the survival of the fittest. In the process of selection, millions of lives are sacrificed, and much birthing of forms comes to naught. Hence, the achieving of soul life is a rare event. Well, let's just say all experience in form life is noted in the soul realm. So that corrects that erroneous teaching. But soul life, people don't have souls. You know, it's like, what does that really say? They don't have a consciousness. They don't have a surviving consciousness. What, they're just material beings? Hence, the achieving of soul life is a rare event. Few people have souls, and only a few, therefore, possess immortality and go hence to their own place of power to return no more. Very selfish, you know, what can I say? Very selfish and exclusive and egotistical. But you see that some Christians believe that not everybody has a soul, you know. And certain groups just don't have souls. But then soul is such a difficult word to really define, and you need the constitution of man to discuss this intelligently. So what should it be? The rest are lost, submerged, and swallowed up in the general process of nature, and the human kingdom as a whole is a dead loss, except for a few emerging and significant figures, which the past and the present produce. They have achieved the sacrifice of the many. So many are called, but few are chosen. And this is a mounting or a climbing, you might say, of the mountain of spiritual ambition. You know, survival of the fittest, and only a few of us, and I'm going to be one, will make it and actually have a soul, get a soul, be a soul. And all the rest, too bad for them, have gone down so that I can ascend. Well, it's so separative, so exclusive, and so untrue. But the reaction of men themselves to this teaching is an adequate answer. I would say it just is not accepted. The sense of immortality, the surety of an eternal future, and I might add an eternal past, the innate belief in God, the revelation of the light, the achieving of wisdom, which helps and aids, is not the prerogative of the Senecas, of the St. Pauls, of the Akbars of the race. Not only them, right? But of all. It is found, and sometimes in its purest form, in the humblest peasant, the achieving of wisdom. Words of wise counsel fall from the lips of the illiterate, and the knowledge of God and the belief in the soul's immortality are discovered to be latent in the hearts of the most unlikely and oft the most apparently sinful. So, you know, let's just say that that the immortal soul exists in all is widely evident, even in those which society rejects. But when the highly evolved and the most intelligent of the race discover in themselves the divine flame of spirit, I guess, and awaken the power of the supreme controller, well, I don't know if it's supreme. Could this be the monad seated at the heart of their being? Because, you know, what can I say? The heart is the life, and the monad is the life, they are very apt to place themselves in a higher category than other people. There is, an egotistical taint in their realization. So the realization is not full. And to classify those who do not have their mental grasp of the differentiations of the evolutionary development as differing so widely from them as to not deserve the names of the Son of God, sons of God. So separative and blind and proud, they regard all not working in mental energy as lacking souls and hence as lacking eternal persistence as individuals. So the theory, unless you can really think, you have no soul. And, you know, fallacy. This is only a glamour of the mind, is part of the great heresy of separateness, and indicates faintly the coming period wherein the mind will be as dominant and as misleading as is the sentient body at this time. So trouble, you know, trouble still lies ahead with every new elevation. And D.K. warned us about the time when the personality is going to be found as a condition within a majority. They will be integrated personalities, not yet the case. And it will bring its own problems. So sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof. We have to deal with what is before us at the moment, and other issues for resolution are forthcoming. Well, okay, friends. He's going to start a new subject here, so let us therefore study the types of mental energy with which the individual has to work and see how this great heresy of separateness and the fallacy of repudiation, as it is sometimes called, can be offset. That's interesting. It's the law of repulse is not that. The law of repulse is an aspect of the law of love. And when we repulse, we are repulsing the things that prevent us from realizing the nature of love. So we're on page 357. And, you know, this has been maybe a two-hour-ish program because I lost my chronometer. Okay, so 357 is going to be about 10 pages. And I will go back to where we left off. And here we are. I like that, the fallacy of repudiation. Wow. Maybe it says even more to me than the great heresy of separateness, or at least it's an aspect of it. So this is number 35, and we've gone from 347 to 357, and today is the 28th of August, and we're on the 19th program. And what that means, and this is going to be number 20. I think number 20. Am I mistaken again? Rule 10, and this is 10. Rule 10, number 35, and this is 10.20. Okay. 10. Let's see. Number 35, rule 10. And this is 10.20. I hope I'm correct here. And maybe I can find out. Sorry to lead you through this. I just want to get this correct. And here we have, I've taken it off onto another disk. Well, okay. Right, well, I think I have it now. So we're going to begin number 36 next, and it will be 10:20, and we've just finished up 10:19, which has led us to page 357, and we begin again on 357. Looks like a new subject, and we can look at this aspect of the law of separateness, not the law, but the heresy of separateness, and that part of it that is called the fallacy of repudiation. So I'm hoping that that is a save, that actually is a save. And I'll know in just a moment whether this is so. And looks like, whoops. Looks like 1720. Yeah, it is. A save is a save is a save. All right. So we have approximately a 2-hour program here, maybe a little more. Sorry for the chronometer. And we will go on with number 36 and 10, the 20th program on Rule 10, and the 36th program for the rules of magic for the astral plane. See you then, and thank you for studying this with me. You obviously see we're scratching the surface here. But if we can instill in our consciousness even a fragment of what is suggested, we will be making progress, and we will be of more use in the presentation of the divine plan, manifestation of the divine plan. All the best. See you soon. Bye-bye.